Good Wednesday afternoon. I'm Kathy Lewis. Today on the broadcast, a look at a Vietnam-era veteran's experience with post-traumatic stress disorder and his advice for veterans of any conflict. And a conversation with Robert Satloff. Satloff has spent the past 20 years at the Washington Institute, where he works with a team of Mideast scholars, experts, and policy practitioners. He's coming to speak tomorrow to the Israel Today Forum in Virginia Beach. And while his perspective on foreign policy is compelling, you won't believe the run-in he had 30 years ago with Fraser Glenn Cross, the ex-KKK leader behind the Kansas Jewish Center killings earlier this month. All that after this news. Two compelling conversations for you today. In the second half of the program, we'll be speaking with Bill Roberts, the author of Beyond Medals of Valor. It's about his experience as a Vietnam combat veteran and his struggles with PTSD. Like many vets, Roberts suffered with symptoms long before there was a diagnosis, and along the way, he learned some powerful lessons about what seems to work for some in dealing with post-traumatic stress, a disorder with which 3 in 10 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are dealing today. And we'll have some news about a special screening coming to WHRO on Tuesday, May 6th. It's called Coming Back with Wes Moore. It's a 3-part PBS series that follows the personal lives of soldiers returning from our most recent conflicts. If you'd like to know more, feel free to log on to our website at whro.org. First, though, a conversation with Robert Satloff. He's a prolific writer, the author of several books, and a Middle East expert. He's coming tomorrow to speak to the Israel Today Forum at 7 o'clock at the Sandler Family Campus of the Tidewater Jewish Community Center. His talk is free and open to the public. Robert Satloff will be coming to Hampton Roads tomorrow to speak as part of the lecture series at the United Jewish Federation of Tidewater. He is an expert on geopolitics, most specifically Arab and Islamic politics and U.S. Middle East policy. He's also the executive director of the Washington Institute, whose goal is to bring a balanced and realistic understanding of American interests in the Middle East and to promote policies that secure those interests. His work has appeared in publications throughout the world, and he's a best-selling author and the creator and host of a show called Doc Hill Washington, Inside Washington. It's a weekly news and interview program that is now in its 7th season on Al Hura, which is the U.S. government-supported Arabic satellite television channel that beams throughout the Middle East. Robert Satloff, thank you for being with us today. I sure do appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's nice to talk with you. We want to get into so much of what you're going to be talking about tomorrow night, where the subject will be geopolitics, and we will certainly talk a bit about that. But I'll tell you, I'm really intrigued by the brush, more than a brush, that you had with Fraser Glenn Miller, the 72-year-old suspect in the Kansas City shootings this month, in which 3 people were killed. This happened on the day before Passover in Overland Park, Kansas. And I was really intrigued to read about the experience that you had with this man when you were in college at Duke.
Yes, this goes back 33 years. 1981, I was an undergraduate, a journalist, reporter for an editor with our daily newspaper at Duke. And I had the idea of going to interview the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. I had read a small article that the Grand Dragon had a paramilitary training camp only an hour outside of campus, and it didn't seem to me that either I or many of my student colleagues had the foggiest idea that there was the Ku Klux Klan essentially around the corner from our campus. And so I called him up, Glenn Miller, and I asked him if I could come for an interview, and he said, sure, just one condition, no blacks, no Jews allowed. And, well, I'm Jewish, but I decided to bend the truth a bit for the sake of getting the interview and explaining to my fellow students what was really going on in our area. And, well, I tried to hide who I was through various ways, but to make a long story short for your listeners, about 10 minutes into the interview, Glenn Miller stopped the interview and well, he said that he could smell a Jew, and the gig was up. And so it ended up that I spent the rest of the day locked in a car under gunpoint as my colleague, who was not Jewish, finished the interview. And I have to say that the on top of the all the scary part of that occurring to me, perhaps the scariest was when I went into the neighboring town with my colleague to ask various people what they thought about having the Ku Klux Klan in their town. Almost to a person, men and women just referred to Glenn as a good old boy and a fine neighbor. And that tells you a lot. I mean, I don't want to paint with a broad brush.
Sure.
That's certainly not the uniform view. But I didn't think that these things happened in America. These exceptions do happen. And regrettably, the man who had guns and extreme views 30 years ago kept the guns and kept the extreme views 30 years later and sadly used them on innocents. None of whom were Jewish, by the way.
Hatred of the kind that he displayed then and obviously displayed some 33 years later, it is all over the country, and it is in places where we might least expect it and is always shocking. I mean, you know, we hear these stories, and yet still every time we hear them, I sort of feel like people want to believe that's not the case. But the fact of the matter is this kind of hatred is alive and well in, you know, all over the country, and thankfully in small but in this case very lethal doses. You know, I wonder in the work that you've done since that time, what an incredibly formative experience that must have been, and you must have been just frightened. I mean, so terribly frightened being held under gunpoint. Did you ever have a sense that? Did you ever have a sense that this man might be so angry at the fact that you had not fully disclosed this that he might kill you or have you shot?
You know, it's one of those strange things. When you're 19 years old, you think you're invincible.
Right.
You think that you can jump off bridges and do all sorts of crazy things. In retrospect, I was foolish that I didn't appreciate the depth of the hate that you we're just talking
yes.
about, and that there are people, they're not just in faraway lands doing terrible things to innocent people, but, you know, our country has, regrettably, its share of them, too. And at the time, it didn't dawn on me, perhaps because I grew up in an environment where these things were so alien, but it didn't dawn on me that they exist.
Mm.
Not in huge numbers. You know, thankfully, our country is not overrun by crazies. But they're there, and they do heinous things, and you see them now and then. And so, in retrospect, it was a foolish, crazy thing to do. But I'm awfully glad I did it, because for me to come face to face with this was a huge learning experience, and to be able to, in some small way, raise a bit of the understanding of all my fellow students and the teachers and everybody else at Duke to what was happening right outside the ivory tower. I still get email and contacts from people from 30 years ago who remember that story. So
it's extraordinary.
That was a service.
And so when this day came, the day before Passover, just this month, and you heard what had happened in Kansas City, and you heard the name associated with this, Frazier Glenn Miller. This is the name that he was actually given another name in 1990 when he was released from prison and the like. But when you made that, what was that moment like when you made that connection that this was the same guy?
I have to say I was blown away. I was totally, totally surprised. I mean, a country of 350 million people, the idea that the same crazy Klansman that held me up at gunpoint 33 years ago is this guy 33 years later doing terrible things hundreds of miles away in Kansas City is a coincidence beyond you know, beyond belief. But it was the same guy. And so I at first I didn't, you know, it was disbelief, but and then it was terrible sadness, the idea that he's still out there, that he was still you know, had this horrible set of ideas, he was still armed, and now he was very sadly, you know, using his weapon on innocence.
Right. You know, this, you know, it seems to me there's a thread, and I wonder if you would agree with this or disagree, that, you know, we talk about people like this man. We talk about people who take religion and radicalize it in ways that lead to death and violence. It seems to me there's some sort of thread there. And I wonder, you know, I wonder what you think about that and all the traveling that you've done. Certainly after the September 11th attacks, traveling, moving your family to Morocco and traveling around the Middle East and Europe and writing about these issues. I wonder if you, what threads you think may be there, or what do you think is underneath all of this?
Well, thank you for asking. It's a very, for me, this is a very important question. It was, in fact, just shortly after the Klan episode in '81 that I took my first trip abroad to the Middle East that summer. 2 months later, traveled to Egypt, traveled around Israel, visited all sorts of people, Israelis, Palestinians, get to know a bit about the politics there, society there. And over the last 30 years, I have spent my professional life trying to understand, you know, what motivates Arabs, Muslims, Israelis in their own societies, in their conflicts with each other, knowing, having seen a little bit of, and it's just a taste, you know, I don't want to exaggerate, but having seen a little bit of the extremism that lives on the margins of our society, helped me greatly to understand the extremism that regrettably occupies a greater share of political space in societies and cultures in the Middle East. And I know a lot more about Middle Eastern politics these days, but the threat is definitely there. I was, you know, a couple of times in various Middle Eastern countries, I've been threatened in various ways, mostly by radical Islamic extremists, quite directly. And each time I hearken back to that experience in rural North Carolina, and count my lucky stars that I've emerged unscathed every time. So, in my book, it's all of a piece. It is a very interesting personal phenomenon.
And so, as you think about radical Islam, you know, I wonder how we get at that issue. It's very interesting to note that the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair is now calling for Western nations to work with the Russian president in this fight against radical Islam, thinking that that really is the core of so much that may heal the region generally. And I wonder if what you think about that. How critical is a resolution or a change or a shift in improvement in the great challenge of radical Islam? How important that is that in the solving of issues in that region?
Well, I'm a big fan of Tony Blair. I thought he gave an absolutely brilliant speech about this just recently. In fact, my organization, the Washington Institute, was proud to give him its highest honor a couple of years ago, and he gave a very similar speech at that event. And his basic point, the point that I agree with wholeheartedly, is that we need to recognize and not be afraid of engaging in encountering the ideological struggle, which is much bigger than just the terrorist struggle. I mean, the terrorists mm-hmm. are the tip of the spear of a much broader ideological struggle against radical Islamic extremism. Blair is right to make the point that this is not against 1.4 billion Muslims, the vast majority of whom reject the ideology of radical extremism, jihadism. But it is against those who do adhere to it. And there are, regrettably, large numbers of such people in many different Muslim societies, and minority and majority Muslim countries. And countering it is as much a political and a social and a cultural effort as it is a traditional national security effort. And Blair is absolutely right that first we need to be aware, first we need to inform ourselves, we need to engage with Muslims who are themselves the greatest victims of radical Islamic extremism. Far more Muslims have been killed by Al-Qaeda, for example, than citizens, than non-Muslims, far more. And they will be our greatest allies in the battle against extremists. So I think Blair is right on the mark. We in the United States have the luxury of having 3,000 miles of ocean on either side of us, peaceful Canada to the north, and generally peaceful Central and South America beneath us. So we feel somewhat immune from these things. But that's a mistake. That's not to say that there's a problem under every mattress, because that's not true. But this is a very serious national security challenge that we avoid at our peril.
We're talking with Robert Satloff, who will be speaking tomorrow night at 7 on issues of geopolitics, Islamic politics, and U.S. Mideast policy. And that's going to be again tomorrow at 7 at the Sandler Family Campus of the Tidewater Jewish Community Center. It's free and open to the public. If you'd like more information or if you'd like to RSVP, it's lhenderson@ujft.org, or you can call 965-6107. And we're glad to have him joining us today in advance of that talk tomorrow evening at 7, free and open to the public, at the Sandler Family Campus of the Tidewater Jewish Community Center. I want to stick with this. You made a distinction between terrorism and ideology, and I hope we might just explore that a little further. And certainly, so correctly stating that that this radical element is a small subset. But I feel so badly for so many of my Muslim friends who seem to get painted with this brush very often. And I wonder, you have spent much of your life in encountering Arabs all over the world, all over the Middle East. What do you think about that piece of it? How painful this is for Muslims who do not ascribe to this philosophy at all?
Well, they're really on the front lines, and so I have enormous sympathy for the vast majority of Muslims around the world who have no truck with radical extremists. They may be Muslims along a broad spectrum of religious practice, like not unlike either Jews or Christians. I'm sure I won't shock your listeners in suggesting that perhaps not every Jewish person abides by all 613 commandments, nor does every Christian person listen to every single suggestion that his priest or pastor or minister offers on a Sunday morning. So too with most Muslims. There's a broad range of Muslim practice. Some are more observant than others, some are more religious than others, but the vast majority reject the idea, the doctrinaire idea, that there is one way to be a legitimate Muslim, and that everything else is not just wrong, but evil and deserves to be killed. Or if you're a If you're a nonviolent extremist, you don't say that the sinner deserves to be killed, but you still say that his practice is sinning that deserves to be shunned, defeated, overwhelmed, and rejected.
Mm.
And that builds an entire culture of hate. And there are regrettably large pockets of in Muslim societies where this ideology, even in its nonviolent form, is growing. And that's a danger first to Muslims, but then more generally, it's a danger to all of us who support the idea of a free and open and tolerant society.
You know, I wonder, there, of course, is this deadline coming up to either finish up or extend these negotiations that have been underway. These are U.S.-backed peace talks that have been underway. And last week, there's this announcement that that rival Palestinian political factions have come to a surprise reconciliation deal, plans for a unified government, and this seems to have really upended some of these negotiations, and it has been very widely denounced, it sounds like, by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So I'm wondering what your take is on that alliance that seems to have been announced, and it is obviously early on in the days of this thing, but I wonder what you think that means in terms of what a lot of people believe might be the most hopeful peace talks in years.
Well, it's a very good question. I think you're right to point out that we're still in the early days of this new relationship between Fatah, which is the party of the president of the Palestinian Authority, and Hamas, which is the radical extremist group which governs the Gaza Strip. They have been split for 7 years now, almost 8 years. They've been split, and the president of the Palestinian Authority has not governed in Gaza. He only governs the West Bank. Now, many people think, well, unity must be a good idea. Unity sounds good. Unity is a very good idea. In fact, in general, there is a choice that leaders need to make. And the choice is unity versus progress, unity or progress toward peace. You can't really have both. You can have either internal unity, or you can make the tough decision to make peace with your adversary.
Mm.
You can't really do both. So, for example, when the Israelis were faced with the decision of doing the deal with the PLO 20 years ago, they took a vote in the Israeli parliament, the Israeli Knesset, under Yitzhak Rabin. And the vote was won by one vote. It ultimately was 61 to 59, which is the opposite of unity.
You're right.
But yet Rabin said, well, we're a democracy, we take votes, and I will choose disunity over progress. I mean, disunity and progress rather than unity. And that's really the same decision Palestinians need to make. A decision to be unified between these two very different groups is really a decision against peace. You know, it's perhaps, it's their decision. They're allowed to make their own decisions. But regrettably, it is a decision against peace. And I think that if this holds, which remains a very big question because we've seen such unity agreements fall apart in the past, If it holds, it will mean the end to this a very noble effort that John Kerry has made, quite remarkable investment of time and capital to try to overcome differences.
Diplomacy is not a straight line, is it? And you know that so well in all the work that you've done throughout your extraordinary career. Robert Salafona, thank you so much for joining us today. It's going to be a fascinating conversation tomorrow night at 7. And I'm really glad you're coming to the community, and it'll be a pleasure to hear from you tomorrow night. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Robert Satloff is the author of The Battle of Ideas and The War on Terror, Essays on U.S. Public Diplomacy in the Middle East. He's also the author of Among the Righteous, Lost Stories of the Holocaust's Long Reach into Arab Lands. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at 7 at the Sandler Family Campus of the Tidewater Jewish Community Center. And if you are interested in reservations, here's the number to call. 965-6107. Up next, a conversation with Bill Roberts, the author of Beyond Medals of Valor. Stay with us. Bill Roberts volunteered for the Army back in 1965 and served in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive. Like many Vietnam veterans, he came home to a country in conflict over its participation in that war. Roberts' experiences with post-traumatic stress, a disorder for which there was no name back then, became the lens through which he sought to help others. He's chronicled his experiences in a new book. It's such a pleasure to have Bill Roberts joining us. His new book is called Beyond Medals of Valor, Vietnam Combat Veterans Life Struggle with Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder and His Adventurous Life Experiences. Bill Roberts, good to have you with us today.
You're welcome.
We should note that the situation when you came home from Vietnam was entirely different in so many important respects than the situation that's now happening for young men and women coming out of Iraq, Afghanistan, and the most recent wars overseas. What was that like from a societal standpoint at that point?
Well, when I got out, you know, I was flown out of a combat zone, and 3 days I was back in civilization, back in the States. And so I didn't know what to do with myself. I knew I didn't fit in. You see, when people are through a lot of combat or through a lot of really bad traumatic experiences, they come out with their souls damaged. And so my soul was damaged. And as human beings, you know, we're all fragile, and we just can't, no matter how tough we try to be, we can't quite conquer things that we weren't really familiar with, like killing people and having your friends die around you. So when I got out, I went to college thinking I would survive off the GI Bill and student loans, which I did. And at that time, this was 1969, and the colleges and universities were right in the middle of an anti-war period of time, and there were demonstrations all over the place, you know, peace and love and totally anti-establishment. There was a social revolution going on when I got out, making it harder for me to adjust, not to mention the difference, you know, with the Vietnam War is we weren't welcomed home at all. And so Vietnam vets just kind of kept it hidden and tried to get on.
So when you say your soul was damaged, at what point did that start to become apparent to you? Because it sounds like you came back, like many folks did at that time, and sort of tried to figure your way back into civilian life.
Well, what I mean by my soul being damaged is I was involved in, like many other combat vets, in killing people. And I suffered a tremendous amount of grief from my friends around me who died, because we were all very close. And so what I mean by my soul being damaged and others is that I wasn't raised that way. I mean, I believed in all of that from watching cowboy movies and all of that, and I was internalized all those American values of war. And I thought it was something other than it would be. And so when I was right in the middle of it and going through all of this stuff, terror that I went through, my soul was damaged in the process. Mm. And I don't think I'll ever get that back.
Wow.
My soul, of course, I'm talking about my deep-rooted values of right and wrong and my religious beliefs.
That's a lot to handle at one time.
It really is. And when you don't have any place to come home to, like Vietnam, thank God the veterans now are welcomed home, and there's still tremendous problems with PTSD and suicide. A couple weeks ago, I read that every 80 minutes, a veteran dies of suicide, and that 20% of the people coming back now have some major post-traumatic stress problems. That's one in five.
Yeah.
Now, there are people in life that have had terrible problems with post-traumatic stress. To give you an idea of what I'm talking about, is I was a counselor, and I was working with a man who had to quit his job, and he worked his way up into commander of a fire department. And this guy had been on the scene all over the place of horrible accidents for over 20 years. And he said that one time he just broke into tears when he was on a call in front of his men, and he could no longer work because everywhere he drove, he remembered where the accidents were and the details of that accident. And it just came back to hit him right between the eyes. And that's what they mean by post-traumatic stress. You can be doing fine, cruising along. Something triggers off some really bad memories, or smells that trigger off memories, or geographical areas look like where they were fighting in the war, and it just... what they might hear in the news, anything can trigger these things off, and they just come back and they hit you right between the eyes.
And as you write, and as you discovered in your work, and I think this is such an interesting point, sometimes this doesn't happen for years and years.
That's right.
And years, which makes it so critically important to be aware of that time frame that might intervene.
Yeah.
So as you have worked with veterans with PTSD over time, what do you think are the prevailing myths that we need to sort of bust about post-traumatic stress? Because it occurs to me one of them has to do with who gets post-traumatic stress. And a lot of people think it's just military people, but I'm becoming aware that post-traumatic stress is a condition that affects people out of the military too, depending on what your experience is.
That's right. A wide range of people are affected by traumatic experiences they had in life, some more than others, some to the point where they might go off and kill people or commit suicide. Some, they're bothered with dreams and having a hard time working, but it's a full range of stress that people go through when they've had, these traumatic experiences in life.
And we should note that just because you have gone through a trauma doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have PTSD either.
It's
really only a very small portion of people who've gone through trauma who will develop PTSD. And I understand that women are more likely than men to develop PTSD. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. But we didn't see women at all when I was in Vietnam.
Right, right.
They didn't have any such thing.
And, of course, it makes it interesting because, you know, now we're at this moment where we do have a lot of women serving overseas, so it'll be interesting to see how they deal with this, how they deal with this over time. You've done quite a lot of work with veterans from your era and others on dealing with post-traumatic stress, and there are a lot of theories out there on what to do and how to do it. I wonder, in your experience, what you think works best, and if you could walk us through some of that, which I'm sure is very dependent on the circumstances.
The adjustment period we're talking about, but first, the symptoms of post-traumatic stress. A major one is anxiety that can be set off by anything, and we talked about people having anxiety and panic attacks. It's a real problem. Depression and suicide, hypervigilant, laying awake all night, analyzing noises, always ready for something horrible to happen, even in a restaurant or whatever, and it never does. Sleep problems, of course. And then difficulty in establishing personal relationships. And so those are some of the main symptoms of and depression, of course. I don't think I mentioned depression, of PTSD. Now, there's ways to adjust to this. As veterans get home, they can, a lot of them self-medicate, making them feel like, you know, that'll make them feel better, drugs and alcohol. There's a big problem with that, and of course, that's not going to help. It's like throwing gasoline on the fire. And then there's denial. Most people come back and they say, I'm just going to forget about all that stuff, and I'm going to get on with my life, only later on to be hit with this real hard post-traumatic stress. Some people deal with it by becoming extremely religious, that was God's war. God made them, told them to go do this, and what they did was pleasing in the eyes of God. But that doesn't hold water a lot if they study religion and they know that God is a loving God, and it just doesn't seem to make any sense. And as they find out that the war really wasn't worth going over there for to fight. To have trouble with that, patriotism. People adjust by becoming extremely patriotic. I know lots of people have pride, and they're so proud of serving the country, and people thank them for their service.
In terms of helping people adjust to and deal with post-traumatic stress, I wonder, how do you do that?
Therapy and medication is really important, you know, through the VA, and that helps a lot with sleep and depression and anxiety. They have medication for that. But also finding the truth. If people really want to get better, they're going to have to find the truth, and sometimes that's hard to deal with. But what I discovered, aside from what therapies are available and veterans taking care of veterans and all of that stuff, I had an epiphany when I got out and I was in the middle of all this crazy stuff going on in society, and I was extremely suicidal. I got this job, part-time job through the colleges, working at a boys' home for court-placed delinquent teenagers. And it was an epiphany for me that I just started feeling better because I discovered, this was my great discovery, that helping other people, in this case those teenagers, it took the focus off of my own misery. And I had to start helping with them and helping them with their problems. And I started feeling really good. It was rewarding, and I started feeling really good about that. That's what continued me on in a major in college for public service, you know, and I became a counselor, and I majored in sociology to try to figure out how I got involved in the Vietnam War in the first place.
This really becomes then for you a real moment, doesn't it, where you really see and understand the idea of civic engagement and volunteerism as a real benefit for veterans, particularly those who are having a hard time getting readjusted.
I think it's the best medicine of all of the medicines out there, it's the best medicine. And I went on to work in a college as a counselor, as a director of disabled student services. So I had all these people that were disabled and couldn't get through college unless special arrangements were made for them so they would have a level playing field. And I did that for 30 years, and that was very beneficial to me. And then we, close to my retirement, we built an RV park. We started from the ground, my wife and I, as a retirement venture. And we thought it'd be people just coming off the highway to stay overnight, but it turned out to be more of a permanent living situation. And so we built a community. We got to know people that were very, very poverty-stricken, and I have a lot of stories about them and their personal lives. And how they mixed with people that would come in overnight with these big, huge motorhomes. And we did this through a lot of social interaction and established some norms of helping each other and waving to people in the morning, watching out for each other, being good neighbors. And so that was really healing, too. Both my wife and I worked with people.
It sounds great. One of the other things that you have recommended that people with PTSD undertake is the idea of an anchor, something that you can touch or look at that reminds you of a different, better time. What's the role of that, and why, and how have you seen that?
Well, there are plenty. Family's the key. There are plenty of wonderful, loving experiences, and I've known some vets who abuse their families, and we would talk about that in group. You know, the family is the only thing you have. Cherish them. That's where all the love and all the special moments that people remember is a family, and that becomes more important as you get older. But that's a key thing to get involved in, and of course, that's along with vacations and nice sights and volunteer work. You know, right now, a couple of years I handed out food to the poor, and now I've just started a job as a volunteer in a convalescent part of a hospital. Just friendly chat, and with people who don't have long in their lives, and they're just so old, and they need to talk. They need to establish personal relationships and have somebody listen to them and care about them.
You know, Bill, it was interesting to me. A couple of months ago, we had a group on from the College of William & Mary. They've done a really intriguing program that's being replicated, or that's trying to be replicated across the country, to help veterans who are trying to get in touch with their benefits. It's sort of a last case option for veterans to connect them with their benefits and make sure that they're getting what they so richly deserved. They're hearing from a lot of Vietnam-era veterans whose records through the mists of time have been lost and the like. And the thing that struck me about those conversations is they were saying that they really want to make sure that the Vietnam-era vets know that they're there, because the Vietnam vets have so often had the experience of not being cared for that many of them, they believe, have just given up and gone away.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't want to take away any credit of modern day veterans. They're under horrible stress also. But in the Vietnam era, yeah, it wasn't a popular war, and they didn't even have a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress when I got out. And they had no services for at least 15 years that I can remember.
Yes.
There was nowhere to go. And then when they did, they didn't, and they still today are understaffed and underfunded. And there's still a problem. But for Vietnam vets, it was really, really hard. And that's why there were so many people that died of suicide, probably twice that of died in the actual war, which was about 60,000 people.
Well, Bill Roberts, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Again, the new book is called Beyond Medals of Valor. And thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Take care. Bye-bye. And here's something we haven't done in a while, but we wanted to check in with Paul Shagrew, and here is his CD of the week.
Ray LaMontagne's new album, Supernova, comes almost 4 years since his last, the winner of Best Folk Album at the Grammys. The years between have been troublesome for the singer as he struggled with his identity as a songwriter, not wanting to repeat himself. Things clicked, though, when he teamed up with highly in-demand producer Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys, who produced and fronted the band for his new album. LaMontagne says he approached the new album with a sense of freedom, pursuing songs that were a little different from what he'd been working on. The result is that some of the songs are constructed more like 60s psychedelic rock, with electric guitar, vocal reverb, and a full band backing him up. Surprising is, despite the tweaking to his overall sound, he's maintained his musical identity laid out in his first four albums.
I've been a savior, a sad man, a stranger stung by anger, burned by love.
Auerbach pulls off the same magic he did for Dr. John on his Grammy-winning album, by leaving LaMontagne's unique voice the center of attention as he sings his songs of love and loss with slightly more polish and less pastoral than before. The best example of this collaboration between LaMontagne, the acoustic balladeer, and Auerbach, the leather-clad rocker, is a dreamy, slightly dangerous-sounding song.
Walk through the field,
LaMontagne has been one of our best songwriters over the 10 years since his debut came out, and it's to be expected that an artist succumbs to a little wanderlust by the time he gets to his fifth album. On Supernova, he uses that urge to explore in a way that will only add to his legacy. Supernova by Ray LaMontagne. It's the CD of the week on Out of the Box. Listen for songs from it Monday through Thursday, 7 to 9 p.m., Saturday afternoon from 1 to 5, and on demand at whrv.org/out of the box. I'm Paul Shagrew. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Paul. We certainly always want to keep you up to date on services for veterans in the community. One of them is the Hampton Roads Veterans Business Outreach Center at Old Dominion University. This is designed to provide entrepreneurial services like business training and counseling and mentoring and referrals for eligible veterans who are owning or want to consider starting a small business. And this is funded in part by a cooperative agreement with the SBA, and they have an extensive network of partners to help connect veterans with business opportunities in the entrepreneurial arena. So if you're interested in more information, go online and look for the Hampton Roads Veterans Business Outreach Center. We also want to let you know about a series coming in May to WHRO. It's called Coming Back with Wes Moore. And on May 6th, you'll be able to come to the studios here at WHRO to see a screening of this series and to hear from local veterans as they talk about the realities of coming home. This series, again, is called Coming Back with Wes Moore, and it is a 3-episode series produced by best-selling author and Army veteran Wes Moore. It tells the story of his own search for answers to some of the most difficult questions facing veterans who are returning from war. And Moore's particular journey was spurred by the suicide of one of his oldest friends and a fellow officer. And so using that as a lens through which to look at this conflict and its impact, Wes Moore takes us into the personal lives of different soldiers as they attempt to reintegrate into culture here in America, establishing their new identities. And for many of them, it's all about finding a new mission. And each of these episodes focuses on a different stage of coming home. The one on May 13th will be called Coming Back. On May 20th, it's Fitting In. And on May 27th, it's Moving Forward. But you'll get to see the entire series if you join us at a free screening event here at WHRO on May 6th at 6:30. It's free, it's open to the public, and after the screening, there'll be a panel discussion where you'll get to hear from local veterans talking about the realities of coming home. Space is limited, so if you are interested, it would be important to reserve a space today. Just log on to the website at whro.org, and that has all the information about how you can register for that free screening coming up May 6th at 6:30 right here at WHRO. That's made possible, by the way, in part by the Thomas Nelson Community College and the Virginia Air and Space Museum. So, hope that's some information that will be helpful to you, and we will see you right back here tomorrow for our editorial roundtable. Don't miss it. Thanks so much for listening today. If there's something we missed in today's broadcast or an idea that you have for us, it's easy to be in touch. hearsay@whrv.org is our email address. You can also log on to our Facebook page. Just surf on over to Hearsay with Kathy Lewis, and we'll be glad to take your thoughts, your comments, and your ideas right there. As well, you can download our podcast, which is available to you at iTunes, and it's been really interesting to watch the growth of the podcast. Lots of you are now listening via podcast on demand, and we're happy for you to have that opportunity. So whether you listen to us live or on a delayed basis, we're always glad to have you in the conversation. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.